This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's big news in the publishing world. The editor of the New Yorker magazine, Robert Gottlieb, is leaving and will be replaced by the editor of Vanity Fair, Tina Brown. The New Yorker, more than any other magazine, represents America's literary pantheon. It's so literary, it doesn't even have photos. Vanity Fair is famous for its eye-catching photos of celebrities and its profiles of the rich and celebrated. So writers and readers are wondering what this change will mean. It was only 5 years ago that William Shawn, the revered longtime editor of The New Yorker, was replaced by Robert Gottlieb, who had been the head of the book publishing house Knopf. Now Gottlieb says he's leaving because he can't carry on the type of changes desired by the publisher Cy Newhouse. Change? The New Yorker has been famous for its consistency and its resistance to trends. But the circulation and advertising pages of the magazine were down last year. We called one of America's most celebrated novelists, John Updike, who got his start at The New Yorker almost 40 years ago and has been writing short stories and book reviews for the magazine ever since. I asked his reaction to yesterday's news.
As to Tina Brown being named editor, it was almost as surprising in a way as the concept of Ronald Reagan becoming president. Reagan did become president, and Tina Brown is now going to be the editor, and I don't want to prejudge her reign. She certainly has been a successful editor over at Vanity Fair and seems to have the trust of the Newhouse organization.
What seems to be incongruous about the choice of Tina Brown?
Well, I associate her mostly with the very photographic and somewhat scandal-mongering Vanity Fair, and Vanity Fair, in a kind of classy way, has developed in the last 5 or more years as everything the New Yorker tried under Shawn not to be. If you follow me, it's almost an anti-New Yorker in a way, in that it is topical and gossipy and tries to catch our attention with every month with a new murder among the rich. I don't know, there's a kind of National Enquirer feeling about it, whereas the New Yorker, as it had developed under Shawn, was almost a scholarly magazine. It has a kind of literary magazine flavor to it. But, you know, I was thinking a little bit about the New Yorker's origins, and the magazine that Ross and then Thurber and White and a number of others got out in the 20s and early 30s was kind of a sassy magazine, so maybe Tina Brown will bring back some of the original sass into the publication.
What has being in The New Yorker meant for you as a writer? What do you think you've been able to do there that you perhaps wouldn't be able to do in other magazines nowadays?
Well, it's very hard for me to picture my life as a writer without The New Yorker, since I basically depended upon it to support me for most of my writing life. I fell in love with the magazine when I was an early teenager, maybe even a 12-year-old, and aimed myself at getting into its pages and was lucky enough to get into its pages at a fairly young age. And for many years, even up until I wrote Couples, I basically depended upon the New Yorker to support me. The checks they gave for short stories went a long way in the 50s and early 60s, and I'm just very grateful to it, grateful that I happened to please Shawn and the other editors around him. You know, the New Yorker seemed to me then to be made up of very wise, older men, and I still have a little bit of that attitude toward the New Yorker, that it is made up of wiser, older people, even though most of them are now younger than I.
I think any time the leadership of an organization changes, you wonder what your individual future will be there, and I'm sure a lot of the writers at the New Yorker are worried now. Are you concerned about your future at the New Yorker?
Not really. I'm 60 years old, and I've kind of made my splash and have some savings in the bank, so I don't really need it as urgently as I did when I was 30. Had there been a revolution when I was 30, I would have been very distressed and felt very threatened. But Tina Brown has already said she doesn't intend to go in for radical changes, so my plan would be merely to submit short stories and poems and book reviews as I have been doing, and see what happens. I think if I were a staffer there, yes, I would be worried about my job and what it all meant. She surely will make some changes as she settles in.
When William Shawn left the magazine and was replaced by Robert Gottlieb, there was a protest at the magazine, and there's really nothing of that sort that I know of happening now this time around. What do you think the difference is?
Well, I think in a way this is so stunning that nobody. Also, I believe people are actually almost too stunned to protest, and also, of course, the Newhouse organization has demonstrated already when they put Gottlieb in that they own the magazine and they are free to make editorial changes. So maybe all of the protest kind of went out of the staff 5 years ago. Shawn was, you know, had a very long time there as editor, and he had followed Ross, so there was a kind of long image of the magazine as an inviolate club above it all, above money worries, above reader complaints, you know, kind of really above it. It was a unique place, and that particular kind of uniqueness, I think, went when Shawn went, and now it's just, I wouldn't say one more magazine, but it somehow feels closer to the real world than it did in the Shawn days.
Do you think something was really lost when Shawn left?
The sense of the supernatural was lost, at least for me. He was kind of a magical man who ran the magazine with absolute authority and a very soft touch, and I kind of revered him. I think we all did. He had magic jumps of taste where he would choose something very surprising, and the magazine, in a way, had a surprisingness in the Shawn days that I'm not sure it's had in the last 5 years. So yeah, he was a magical a magical person. Yeah, of course, he was mortal too. He had gotten on in years, and I think probably it was time for a change. It's hard to picture anybody who would have changed it more gently than Gottlieb, himself a very scholarly, bookish man who I think tried to refreshen the magazine within the existing framework. What Tina Brown will and can do with it, I can't imagine.
What were the changes like inside during the 5 years that Robert Gottlieb was the editor?
Well, he was more accessible than Shawn and more forthcoming with his opinions. He wasn't enigmatic in a way that Shawn was, and I think there was more camaraderie in the staff. I myself fairly rarely visit the place, so I didn't feel it so much. But, you know, he was an impulsive, warm guy who wasn't afraid to say what he thought, and the changes in the style of the articles and then even in the look of the magazine, the readers can see as well as I. But it was, I'd say, a more informal, warmer place to work with Bob there.
Would you describe where you see the New Yorker fitting in terms of the contribution it's made to American literature and nonfiction writing?
Well, I think it's existed really as a bridge between the highbrows and the middlebrows that it has offered in the poetry and the fiction, and even in some of the journalism, a standard of writing and a complexity of intent that no other popular magazine, general magazine, was offering. Really, there's nothing like it, and if it goes in its present form, I think a very important bridge will be lost between, in a way, the writing world and the reading world, that are the American middle class and the intelligentsia of the country. It was a place where you could see John Ashbery's poems and Nabokov stories, and yet see it in a kind of glossy, prospering context. And that was its a unique quality, and I would hope that can be sustained somehow.
Do you still read The New Yorker?
In part. I never read all of it. I do try to keep up with the books and the poems and the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I often skip some of the nonfiction. It, you know, it comes every week, and that's a lot of words.
Yeah.
Today's world.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay. Nice to talk to you.
writer John Updike. We'll be back with more on the changes at The New Yorker after a short break. This is Fresh Air. The editor of Vanity Fair magazine, Tina Brown, was named yesterday to take over as editor of The New Yorker. In the May issue of Spy magazine, she was profiled by Jeffrey Stokes, the former media critic for The Village Voice. We called Jeffrey Stokes, and I asked him if he thought the appointment of Tina Brown to The New Yorker represented a larger trend in magazine publishing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of the way that magazine publishing has headed, that we've seen for a long time, and I think Vanity Fair is simply the sort of flagship of the process, but which began probably most spectacularly with People, of trivializing and celebritizing magazine journalism. The tricky thing that Tina did, and one has to give her credit for, at Vanity Fair, was that she did all those People-ish cover things, and at the same time did manage to produce some quality writing in the magazine, some important reporting.
You profiled Tina Brown a couple of months ago in Spy magazine, and in that profile you described her as equally willing to threaten and to grovel in pursuit of her grail. Examples of how she would threaten and grovel?
Sure. The groveling, the classic example, perhaps, was a letter she wrote to Michael Ovitz, the Hollywood mega agent who produces great quantities of celebrities for her magazine. And she wanted to do a profile of him and wrote this extraordinary letter, which raced around the New York publishing world and was eventually published in Spy, in fact, in I think August of 1990, saying, you know, oh, we hear Premiere is going to do you, and they won't do you fairly. We will do, in essence, anything you want to have you in our magazine. That's the grovel, okay? The threats are generally dedicated, of course, not to people who are potentially her peers or equals in power, but to staffers, writers, underlings in general. A classic story, and actually one that I used in the Spy magazine piece, involved a young writer just beginning to establish himself as a freelancer who'd done some work for Vanity Fair. And he was at a meeting in her office when he casually mentioned that he was had agreed to be interviewed for a profile of her that one of the newsweeklies was doing. And after the meeting, she pulled him aside and said, you know, listen, young man, if you agree to an interview about me, you will never write for this magazine again, and you will never write for any other Condé Nast magazine. Mm-hmm. That'll get your attention.
Right. What contributions do you think Vanity Fair has made to the furthering of, personality journalism?
Well, I think there's a quite conscious and cynical use of the cover to sell the magazine. I mean, quite often, and it's an interesting phenomenon, you pick it up, you'll see, Starlet A is on the cover. You open it up and you realize that there are two pages of really undistinguished prose by a second-rate Vanity Fair writer about the cover story, while there's 7,000 words about someone you might not even have heard of before. So there's a kind of cynicism in that. I mean, and she's, you know, says this unashamedly, right? I mean, Kevin Costner on the cover gives me the right to do what I want to inside. But Vanity Fair was a leader in that. I mean, its success created the phenomenon, not only of the cover, right, which is one thing, but of the deal. Yes, you know, if you'll give us the cover, if you'll sit still for a photo shoot, well, you know, then sure you can have quote approval, or sure you can have writer approval, or yes, we won't ask you about your sexuality, or some other subject that you don't want to discuss. And all of that's negotiated ahead of time. So the reporters go out there with their hands tied, and readers are reading pre-censored material.
Can you sum up what you think Tina Brown's greatest accomplishments have been as an editor, and what your greatest criticisms of her as an editor would be?
Sure. I think her greatest accomplishments have been in some way commercial. That is to say, she has sold a lot of copies of a magazine. In the process of doing that, she has found or recruited, at any rate, some very talented writers. She's resuscitated what it seemed to me was a dying genre, which is the true crime story. She's sussed out trends, I think, fairly early on. Menopause, the current menopause boom, right, being a classic example of that. I also think in other ways, she was first, in part, I think, because of the limitations of the monthly deadline, to really home in on the so-called character issue of presidential candidates, and that's something that I think newspapers, as well as magazines all over the country, are imitating this year. Sure, she was aided by Gary Hart's inability to keep his pants buttoned, but that phenomenon, I think, is very real. And treating candidates as celebrities rather than as people who represent a package of ideas and a direction for the country. So I think all of that is accomplishment, and some of it is criticism. I think, too, certainly in criticism, one has to deal with the kind of sycophantic treatment that Vanity Fair gave to its favorite subjects, whether they were advertisers or personal friends of its editor.
When you say advertisers, you mean stories about advertisers?
Sure.
Stories about people who advertise in...
Yeah, I mean, here's Ralph Lauren. In 1987, he takes out 34 or 37 pages of ads in the magazine. And in 1988, he's on the cover with this incredible wet kiss of a piece.
Is this something you think other magazines have picked up on, too?
I think other magazines have been less shameless about it, to their credit. Though there's always enormous pressure, particularly when the economy turns down, right, as it did, as it has and is continuing to do for the magazine industry still, at least, not to offend advertisers, and indeed to help them out in ways if you possibly can. And, you know, the sort of silken curtain or Chinese wall, or pick your metaphor, between editorial and advertising that was established, say, at The New Yorker, right, quite strongly, was just shredded by Vanity Fair.
You know, Vanity Fair and The New Yorker may be poles apart in terms of their identity as magazines, but they're owned by the same person, Cy Newhouse. And, you know, he's decided it's time for a change. Do you have reservations about this kind of conglomeratization of magazine publishing?
Oh, yes and no. I mean, it seems to me to be a danger, more of a danger in the newspaper business than in the magazine business, partly because so many towns are served by only one newspaper. So many cities have only one newspaper. And if they're being dominated by chain coverage, that's a real problem. The magazine business remains pretty diffuse. I mean, you know, Condé Nast may be Gargantua, right, or Godzilla, but Hearst is King Kong, and there are independent rivals and city magazines and independently owned publications that are nationally circulated. I'm less worried about that. I'm also not entirely sure, when you talked about The New Yorker and Vanity Fair being antithetical, they aren't quite, you know. I mean, there are pieces in Vanity Fair that you could have set in a different typeface and run in The New Yorker.
That's a really valid point.
You know, and the other way around. I mean, the true crime genre, right? For years, the best and perhaps the only genius at that in the magazine business was Bud Trillin, Calvin Trillin, at mm-hmm. The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that the... And any of those pieces could have run in Vanity Fair, and the other way around, right? On some of, particularly some of the international reporting at Vanity Fair. I think Vanity Fair was driven by the story, and The New Yorker by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And when it worked, when the writing at The New Yorker was as sharp as it has sometimes been, right? You could read John McPhee on oranges, right? And it would be wonderful. You could also read E.J. Kahn, a five-parter on the history of grain, right? And constantly be bruising your forehead on the dining room table as it fell forward. You know, it's... But you would not have seen either of those in Vanity Fair because they didn't have a hot peg.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a difference. And I don't know how she's going to deal with that. I would hate to see the loss of the quirky, cranky, idiosyncratic story that The New Yorker has really made a niche for.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Journalist Jeffrey Stokes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.